Welcome to House Finance. The time is 9:20. Let's go ahead and get started so that maybe we can get through most of Dr. Van Meer's presentation. And Dr. Tony Finizza will come online hopefully here in a bit if he's not yet online. Pedro, if you want to come up, for the record, 9:20, we have Representative Moses, Representative Foster, Representative Hawker, Representative Jewell, Representative Curtula, Vice Chair Stoltz, Co-Chair Meyer, myself, Co-Chair Chenault. Also with us, we have Representative Olson, Representative Seaton, and I thought I seen Representative Berkowitz in here earlier. So as other members come in, I'll try to announce that they are here. First off, we're still taking up SB 305, oil and gas production tax. We've asked Dr. Van Meers to, from the Office of the Governor, to run through the PPT issues in a presentation to finance, and we've also asked Mr. Finizza, our Econ 1 research contractor, to run us through 305 and the changes that have been made. We've also been trying to contact Daniel Johnston, the legislative consultant, and has yet, we haven't been able to get him online. We're hoping to, but we'll see if that does indeed happen. So with that, the plan today is to take, to hear from Dr. Meers and Dr. Finizza between now and 11 o'clock, and then we'll take a break. We'll come back at 1 to 3 to listen to public testimony from Anchorage, Fairbanks, and then all other areas between 1 and 3. So with that, Dr. Van Meers, floor is yours.
It's a great pleasure again to make some comments on the PPT legislation at this final stretch of this very important process. A number of very important items have been discussed in the past, so I thought I would concentrate just on a number of items that I think are of great importance. The first issue that really concerns me deeply was when I became aware that the Senate Finance Committee had adopted a 25% tax credit rate. And as you know, in my February 14th report, I recommend against that, and I recommended against such a high tax credit rate. And I like to, and I haven't really explained before to the legislature as to why I actually recommended against that. And maybe it is a good point at this point in time to focus on that. Prior to the PPT law being presented, we did extensive analysis on heavy oil, because of course the future of the state, the future of the oil production of the state is very much linked to heavy oil. And in fact, myself, I was very sympathetic initially to maybe encouraging heavy oil with this special tax credit that was higher than light oil. And I therefore intensively studied the possibility for a 25% tax credit. Of course, we need to focus again on the great importance of heavy oil. In my work, actually, I focused more on heavy oil. Roger Marks in his projections, particularly the long-term projections, also assumed that much more light oil may become available, say, from Anwar and other areas. But I feel personally that heavy oil is a very important piece of the equation of future production in Alaska. Not just in Alaska, worldwide, there is clearly a focus now on heavy oil, this the higher oil price expectations. And consequently, Alaska's blessed with this very large heavy oil resources, maybe depending on prices and depending on, say, economic further development of technology, there could be as much as 2 or 4, who knows, maybe even 5 billion barrels of viscous and heavy oil on the North Slope. And some of that may be recoverable at long-term prices of $35 per barrel. What we need to, if we talk about heavy oil, what is very important to realize, it is not that there are two distinct different types of oil, like heavy oil and light oil. The problem that we are facing on the North Slope and worldwide is that there is actually a whole gradation of oils. So you have viscous and heavy oil of 22 degree API, 19, 16, it goes down to 10. And the value of the oil rapidly diminishes if you go from, say, 25 degree API to 10 degree API. For instance, if you look at California, where very heavy oils are being produced today in the Kern River area, then that oil is worth $10 less than light oil. So consequently, if you look at the real 14 degree API, the really heavy, heavy oil, that oil is worth a lot less than light oil. So that is the first problem. The second problem is that the cost of production go up very much as you go from 25 to 22, 19, 16, 40. Say, by the time you get to 14 degree API, the cost per barrel may be as much as $15 to $20 a barrel. So while if you are in 22 degree API, it may only be $8 a barrel. So consequently, the cost of producing heavy oil goes up as this oil becomes heavier. The value of this heavy oil goes down as the oil becomes heavier. And the problem is that Alaska has kind of heavy oil of all of these qualities. So consequently, what you find is that heavy oil is not one type of crude. It is a gradation that starts, 25 and goes all the way down to 10 degree API. And therefore, I look very carefully at the possibility of a 25% tax credit, because it is so important for Alaska to stimulate this heavy oil. It is a very large resource for the state. And the future of production is very much linked to that heavy oil production. I reluctantly came to the conclusion, and that is why I recommended to the governor not to have a 25% tax credit, because when I started to do the economics, and you can see that on, slide page 3, when I started to do the economics, it becomes obvious that if you have this very high cost, very low value crude oil, that two things happen. Firstly, because of the lower value of the crude oil, the likelihood that this crude is economic at low prices rapidly diminishes, and in fact, the probability that you end up with a loss carry forward situation rapidly increases. And of course, with the higher cost, also the credits become proportionately higher. So what you will see is that I actually have on page 3 a graph that shows the 2020 system and the 22.5-25 system as it was adopted by the Senate Finance Committee. And you actually see that if you just apply this to, say, something with a 20 degree or a 19 degree API gravity like West Sac type of crude, actually the revenues under 25 below $40 the barrel or less than the 2020 system. And that is because of these very high tax credits. It is also because of the fact that if you get to the lower prices, like $30 or $25, you actually get into a tax loss carry forward situation. So consequently, now you are in the situation where you actually carry forward 47.5% of the capital cost rather than 40% of the capital cost. And that is a very significant burden. Now, this is just a graph on a 100 million opportunity. As I said, there could be 2 billion, up to 4 billion of this heavy oil. And this is actually an example of relatively light heavy oil. If you go to the heavier crude, this differential, which I also studied, becomes progressively more important. So I came reluctantly to the conclusion that Alaska simply cannot afford such high tax credits. The chance that under low prices, under $35 a barrel or less, we start to run too much in a loss situation with this very high tax credit, plus the higher carry forward with the 22.5, and consequently, because of that, I strongly recommended against such a high tax credit when the issue was discussed at the time, so prior to the introduction by the governor of the bill. So consequently, I like to maintain that recommendation. You have to be very careful with tax credits. It is easy to say, but faced with the fact that we could have crude oil of as much as $10, $15 a barrel, you have capital investment, I'm not even talking operating cost, you have to become very careful with high tax credits. And consequently, that is a reason why I, at the time, recommended against it, and I'm still recommending against it. What I also like to discuss is the progressive feature. Both the House Resources Committee and the Senate adopted the concept of a progressive feature. And I like to discuss this progressive feature also in the context of the future of Alaska. What you see on page 4 is that the features have been defined with an oil price which you call in nominal dollars. So the oil price, the progressive feature would start at a particular level of oil price or gas price, if you want to do it on gas as well. And consequently, the important part is what is the starting point. Now, the starting point, of course, if you define this in nominal dollars without an escalation, then what you get is that the value of that starting point will erode over time, because as inflation continues, just with a normal 2.5% inflation as we have today, the value of that starting point, if you start at 50, 30 years later, it is actually 25 in real dollars of today. And if you start at 70 after $30, it is after 30 years, it is 35. What we need to do, therefore, is if we evaluate that starting point for progressivity, we need to be aware of the fact that there is this kind of crossover point. On the one hand, we really need to count for the future of Alaska on increasingly more expensive heavy oil if we want to maintain production. On the other hand, the starting point of that progressivity feature would actually decline in real terms. And then the question becomes, how much can we knock down in the future the capital costs on heavy oil development in real terms? And obviously there will be improvements in technology. The oil industry has been very innovative actually in the North Slope today to lower cost of heavy oil production, and that is the reason why we're even talking about it. And that will probably go forward in the future. So maybe in the future it doesn't cost $50, or you don't need $50 in order to produce a 14 degree API crude. So that line that I showed there, the heavy crude oil line, that's, which is kind of the kind of minimum price that you need to bring heavy oil to market from the North Slope, may not increase as much as I showed it there. But what you see is I do expect there to be a crossover point. And consequently, if that crossover point comes too early, then you may actually hamper bringing about increasingly heavy oils as you go along over the next 30 years. So consequently, that is why I would urge some caution with that price, because people mention prices like $50 or $40 or $60, but it is not realized that that is in nominal terms, and we need to be aware of the fact that over a 30-year period that number reduces in value. So that is why I would express some caution that if you design this progressive feature, that you look at that starting point somewhat carefully. What is also important is to realize that how would you calculate the value on which you base your progressive feature? You can do that on WTI, you can do it on ANS, or you can do it on the actual value, the gross value of production at the production point. Of course, if you think about a heavy oil scenario, doing it on the basis of the gross value of the production at the production point would be more sensitive to future heavy oil developments. So these are things that I would like to leave for your consideration if you consider this progressive feature.
Dr. Record Representative Wyrock's been with us.
I testified a number of times in front of the various committees on the interaction between level of activity and tax rate, and that and actually the slide that I have on page 5 is a repeat of the slide that I presented to other committees. And that is a slide that directly came from my report of the 14th of February. And that slide shows that there is some relationship between the competitiveness of Alaska and the tax rate, assuming a constant tax credit rate. Consequently, my work indicated that, of course, as is logical, the higher the tax rate, the less the Alaska system becomes competitive with other systems in the world, and consequently, the level of activity and the tax rate go together. And consequently, the higher you put that tax rate up, the less Alaska, given a particular level of tax credits, the higher you put that tax rate up, the less Alaska becomes attractive to other areas in the world. And consequently, as long as oil prices remain very high, as long as oil companies believe oil prices are going to be in the $40 or $50 range, and if that is their forecast, then maybe it doesn't matter very much. But by the time oil companies start to look at levels of $35 a barrel, which is really still the long-term price forecast of many international oil companies, or if they do analysis on stress prices as low as 22 or 25, I have done here 26 and 36 scenarios, then of course these matters become quite important, because as you well know, the net back of of Alaska is $5 less than most other crews in the world, most other fiscal areas in the world. So consequently, as I have testified before, if you put the tax rate up, my prediction is that activity goes down. As so many others have testified at various committees, the Alaska oil production is declining. As I also indicated, we need to consider very much that we could maintain or we could reduce the level of decline by bringing on these heavy oil deposits. I'd like to highlight that my competitiveness analysis was done on light oils. If you do it on heavy oils, Alaska looks a lot worse in the international picture than light oils because of the relative great importance of the lower netback. So higher tax rate means less activity. As I have told you before, I cannot estimate with a great amount of accuracy how much less. But we know that the level of investment of $1 billion a year, as we've seen over the last 5 years, is not enough to stop the decline. In fact, we have seen continued decline with that level of investment. We really should try to double that level of investment. We should really encourage companies to invest $2 billion per year. And consequently, particularly if you look at heavy oil, which could be very expensive. So I do believe that you have to be careful with tax rates. That doesn't mean that, as I also have stated in the past, I don't want to dramatize this point. It is not that at 25% or 22.5% you have a monstrous amount of activity or very little activity, and at 20% you have a huge amount of activity. I don't want to portray that there is very large differences in activity if you go for higher tax rate. But it is not right either to argue that there is no impact, and the impact could be sufficient to not redress the strongly declining production that Alaska is facing in oil. That brings me to slide six. Slide six, what concerns me a little bit, what I've seen from the work in the Senate, is that there is a little bit to feel, yeah, we just jack up the tax credit and that then justifies a higher tax rate and we are better off. As I hope that I have explained to you, I don't feel you are better off as Alaska. You have just, all that you have done is you have increased the risk profile to the state quite significantly by going to a 25% tax credit. Tax credit are a risky business. If you are thinking of 30 years of heavy oil, tax credits are a risky business. If oil prices decline again to $35 a barrel, or let alone $25 a barrel, and consequently, as a result, you cannot just ratchet up tax credits and tax rates at the same time. So you have to be careful with that. The risk profile of a high tax credit is very different from a low tax credit. And consequently, you have to take that into consideration if you make your decisions about what the final tax rate and tax credit rate should be. The last slide is a slide where I like to make some comments on the gross revenue exclusion. The Senate came up with a good idea, I think, to have a gross revenue exclusion for gas. And consequently, that actually, that decision is very much in line with where the international trend is. In the North Slope, we are faced with having to transport gas over very significant distances. And if the Alaska Gas Project comes about, then Alaska Gas will have one of the lowest netback or wellhead values for gas in the world compared to other gas exporting regions. And consequently, most nations that were faced with long distance gas exports, most nations and today that are LNG nations, most nations that were faced with costly long distance exports of gas made the decision that the government take for gas should be less than the government take for oil. So what the Senate is doing is really right in line of what all the competitors are doing, what all the competitors of Alaska are doing. So consequently, the Senate concept of having a gross revenue exclusion for gas, I think is consistent with international policies and is consistent with a competitive environment for Alaska gas. Indonesia, some governments have modest lower government takes. Other governments have very significant differences. My client Trinidad, for instance, has a very significant difference between oil economics and gas economics. And that was actually the reason why they were very early in the game of exporting LNG to the lower 48. One of the very first states to do so, and they did that with a policy of having a lower government take for gas than for oil. So my client Trinidad has been very successful at exporting gas, and now also not only to the U.S. but also to Europe. Indonesia, Malaysia, Qatar, Oman, Venezuela all use the same strategies. They have lower government take for gas than for oil. So I think that that concept of a revenue, gross revenue exclusion, which was not in the governor's bill, I think, and that the Senate introduced, I think, is a good concept. There is a lot of discussion about how large that gross revenue exclusion has to be, and that depends, of course, whether you look at maybe cooking lat, or whether you look at the North Slope, and I haven't done detailed analysis about what the appropriate maybe level of gross revenue exclusion is, but there is no question that the ID is a good one. So that is what I like to leave you with, and so I would recommend that you study that concept also here in the House Finance Committee. So, Daniel, that's the termination of my presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Van Meers. Is there any questions? Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the gas part of it,
yes,
with what the Senate has done, have you run any models? You know, we know that there's, I think, 35 TCF of known gas, and assuming that we do the right things, we may have 50 to 100 and maybe more, hopefully. So based on that and what the Senate has done, are there models, have you modeled anything to show what the long-term effect is for the state?
You mean of the revenue, gross revenue exclusion?
I guess that's, yeah.
Yes.
Do we have the numbers?
Of course, I have a very comprehensive model made of the gas project because, as you know, I'm responsible for doing the economics on the gas project. And I have, therefore, done very extensive economics on the gas, and I look forward to the big binder that you will receive on May the 10th, where a lot of that economic analysis will be provided. The big problem that Alaska faces with its gas relative to other areas in the world is that, as you correctly state, we have an immense resource of gas, a very large resource, 35 TCF. In fact, I believe that it is probably the largest bookable reserve of gas that producers can book compared to any single project in the world, just the 35, let alone gas would be added. So it is a very large project. It is a very large project in terms of capital expenditures. It is also the highest capital expenditure in the world. So consequently, Alaska gas has an unusual risk profile. Under conditions of high cost overruns and low prices, it is a project with extreme risk and extremely unprofitable. At high prices, it becomes a very profitable project. Therefore, I think if you study that gross revenue exclusion, it is important to keep that in mind. As I said myself, I haven't done economic analysis as of this point in time to precisely analyze what different gross revenue exclusions would result in, because it was a new idea that was just launched and I was busy with some other matters in the meantime. So therefore, in my comments, what I like to restrict myself to is that in principle, this is a good idea. This is a good idea that will help, I think, the PPT legislation, because we need to be mindful of the fact that although we talk about a stranded gas contract, that stranded gas contract will be for the sponsors and whatever other companies may obtain similar arrangements. There might very well be producers on the North Slope which will not be part of this agreement. And consequently, that is why it is so important to make sure that the PPT law is good for gas and good for oil, because there might be producers that will not be part of the stranded gas contract. And consequently, if you design the PPT for oil, you have to be mindful of possible producers on the North Slope that will not be part of a future stranded gas contract. And consequently, therefore, it is important to have the law well prepared for oil as for gas.
Hello,
Representative Jewell.
The decision has been made to treat it differently than oil, and we have to make a decision on this legislation. While the principle of it may be a good thing, and while some of that information probably we'll be able to see in the gas contract, it's now included in this piece of legislation, and I'd be real interested to see the modeling that gets done so that it would help us and make the decision about what that means over the life of the gas fields.
There is absolutely no problem doing some of that analysis. The models are there, and consequently, if you so wish, I can see whether I can do some analysis for you on that very topic. It can be done relatively fast. So if there is particular aspects that you're interested in, I would be pleased to consult with this, the governor's office and see whether I can provide you some more background on this particular point. I'm saying I didn't study it because it was a new idea that just came about. I was not even in Alaska when it happened, and consequently I didn't have time to focus on it. But it would not be difficult to focus on.
Thank you.
Representative Couture.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I can certainly understand that it is a new idea, and I'm concerned about it greatly. And I think that you've said in principle, and also that distinction between Cook Inlet and North Slope, which I think may be very critical here. But it seems to me that, you know, you've talked about the risk with a higher tax and a higher credit on oil. And so the same thing concerns me here. Now we've got a lower, you know, tax and the same credit on the gas. So what my fear is that over the long run, we can't help but lose quite a bit of money, billions in the rough calculation on it. So that I'm real interested in seeing what your model shows at the benchmarks, you know, $3, $5, those kind of various benchmarks. And also, if you can, split out what would happen if we split out Cook Inlet and allowed it only there versus the North Slope, which I think is the bigger problem. But it would be very, very helpful, because my fear is that there truly is a terrible risk of losing billions of dollars if this new idea.
Yes, the way I understand the formula, to begin with, sorry, to answer your question, Representative Cazorla, the first thing that I like to highlight is that in order to precisely make it possible for you to judge the PPT law on its own merits, all of the possible credits that would be related to the gas development, and that would be primarily Point Thompson, because the credits that we're talking about are just upstream credits, are just related to the production. At Prudhoe Bay, the gas is already there. So if we talk about credits, then in the case of the gas project, these credits relate primarily to Point Thompson, as well as some other new fields that need to be developed in order to keep the pipeline filled. So the amount of credits actually associated with bringing the gas line forward are very limited. And those credits were already discounted. They were included in the oil information. So all the credits for the gas project, Roger Marks, when he made his forecast, he already included the Point Thompson credits in the oil. So consequently, from that point of view, your concern, I deeply understand your concern, and I think it is very important to look at that. But the credit part of the gas project has already been presented to you. So, and presented to the legislature. So there is no need to fear that there would be additional credits against this gas. So consequently, from that point of view, the gross revenue exclusion does not necessarily have to be compared with the credits that would occur under the gas project, because they have already been presented. The credits in Point Thompson are already in the oil part. So, and the oil part showed, of course, that as long as oil prices are better than $30-$35, you're well ahead of the game. So even with the credits.
Could I just follow up? Well, then I think that is kind of a big misunderstanding, because at least the way I've had it presented, thought it's been presented, is we would have the credits. We would still have the credits against the gas as well. So you're saying that doesn't happen. There's no credits against the gas.
Representative, let me clarify exactly what I meant, and maybe I expressed myself inaccurately. Point Thompson will be subject to the full credits. In other words, if, for argument's sake, if there is $2 billion investment to bring Point Thompson oil and gas about, then a 20% credit would be $400 million. That $400 million in its totality has already been included in the oil revenues that were presented to the legislature. So Roger Marks already deducted the full credits against Point Thompson from the oil revenues. So if you look at the gas revenues to come, you will not subtract any further credits. It has already been deducted from the oil. So consequently, that is why I can understand your concern, but so to speak, the gas would be in the information presented, the gas would be free of credit, so to speak, because it is already deducted from oil.
Okay, I'm not sure, you know, I quite agree, because it's still a credit for the gas. But the one last thing I would request is, can you compare this to our current system, to how this would, what we'd wind up under this current system versus the current severance tax with the ELF? I'd really like to see that comparison, too, to see if we wind up, you know, better or worse with what we have now. Thank you.
It is an important point, and I would be more than glad to do some economics for you on it. I don't have it in my back pocket, but in view of all the other questions, it would not be difficult to generate that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Cretula, I think we'll see something from Econ 1 here shortly on some projections. So.
Great.
Any other questions?
I had a last one if anyone else has one.
Go ahead. That's probably not going to be your last one. But go
no,
ahead.
You're right. You know, I'm the new kid. I just have to do it, right? Last night on the radio, I heard something that the chief of staff mentioned about not putting the gas contract out yet because they didn't have the fiscal certainty on oil section written yet. And I wondered if you've been involved in that and, you know, if you can tell us anything about why we're waiting for that fiscal certainty on oil section.
Of course, I'm, although my main job has been to help in the PPT legislation and then in the economics of the gas project, and that doesn't necessarily mean I'm involved in all of the negotiations, but I'm very much aware of it. The whole concept was that once the legislature has passed a law of general application for oil and gas on the PPT, that legislation, to the degree it applies to oil, because the standard gas contract would modify the legislation, that legislation to the degree it applies for oil would be incorporated as fiscal stability for oil under the contract. So consequently, the contract cannot be terminated, cannot be finalized, unless this PPT piece that the legislature is working on is finalized. So consequently, once the PPT is ready, then there will be connecting language in the contract saying, okay, this was the PPT legislation for oil, with respect to oil that was passed, and consequently now this becomes an element in the contract. So we're really waiting for this legislation to be able to finalize the contract. But otherwise, and there are still some other pieces that we're working on as well, but otherwise all the main blocks, as was indicated by the government a number of times, of the contract have been finalized.
Could I do it?
Representative Cretula.
So whatever the concerns are, so then that makes your concern, and I guess mine too, about the credits on oil all the more important then, because we'd be actually writing these terms into the contract and connecting it then with whatever term the contract is. Is that right?
You're absolutely correct. The credits for Point Thompson, Point Thompson would be the main field, really, that would underpin the gas project. Assume a $2 billion investment, I mean, maybe three, but just for argument's sake. And if you have a 20% credit, which is what I would recommend, rather than 25%, then you are talking $400 million. So that you are talking basically a $400 million issue. That $400 million really is partly for oil, because Point Thompson will generate very important amounts of condensates, which are essential for maintaining oil production. And it will partially applied to gas. So of the $400 million, if you look at the investment credit part, of the $400 million, part of it you could notionally allocate to oil, part of it you could notionally allocate to gas. We felt that it was too complex and from an administrative point of view to try to start separating out which part of the investment belongs to gas and which part of the investment belongs to oil. And given the fact that in the multi-billion dollar gas project, this is only maybe, you know, a $400 million issue at most, we did not believe that this was something that we should make a very complex law for just to solve this. So that is why the credits in Point Thompson apply across the board. Is there some cross-subsidization to gas? Yes, there is, a few $100 million. I mean, if you notionally divide the capital in oil and in gas, is that a very important issue? Of course, whenever you mention hundreds of millions of dollars, that automatically sounds like an important issue. But of course, in the potentially, you know, 60 billion or more revenues that the state may get from the Alaska Gas Project, that is a relatively minor issue. And that is why we felt it wise not to complicate the PPT law for that issue and make complex administrative arrangement whereby you have to start separating, say, oil investment versus gas investments and then break it out, and that would lead to all kinds of unnecessary disputes. So consequently, my own personal view is that this is, in the total scheme of things that we're discussing, it is a minor issue.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe the premise of this question is incorrect, but as I look at the Senate bill, why would we tax $1 billion of profit made from oil, which is three times the tax rate on $1 billion of profit from gas, just given the disparity? Why the big gap?
I'm not sure whether I understand your question.
Well, the tax on gas seems so significantly lower. Why the distinction on the tax on the profit gas compared to oil?
Representative, the recommendation that I understand the Senate was making was not to have a different tax rate. So the tax rate would be the same. So for oil as well as for gas. The idea of the gross revenue exclusion was to say, since gas is a less economic resource than oil at particular price levels, why don't we exclude part of the gross revenues from gas in order to calculate the profit on gas? And consequently, basically, that creates a lower government take for gas than for oil. What is the logic of that? Many nations have faced this particular issue. Say, Qatar or Indonesia or others have faced this particular issue.
He left.
Okay. Would I wait?
Fine.
Okay. I will just. Many nations have faced this particular issue, and say countries like Trinidad, my other client, and Indonesia came to the conclusion that unless you have a somewhat lower government take for gas than for oil, it is very difficult to competitively get your gas in the world market. And I think Alaska will absolutely face the same issue. So consequently, Alaska, as you know, many LNG, there are about 30 or more LNG projects already underway to supply the lower 48 market. Alaska will compete with these projects, and consequently, we have to look at the long list of nations that has designed fiscal strategies to enter the lower 48 market, and we have to learn from that. Therefore, I think it is important to bring through the notion that Alaska, of course, has to compete with these other nations in order to bring gas to the largest gas market in the world. And that is why I believe that the concept of the gross revenue exclusion is a good concept. Of course, and I speak now for the producers on the North Slope, which may not have a gas contract. So we have to be mindful of the fact that there could be producers on the North Slope which will not have a gas contract, and we have to be mindful of the fact that for those companies we have a good PPT law, and I think that is why I would sympathetically consider the concept of what the Senate brought about. As I said, I haven't had time to really analyze the details of it, but it is a good concept in general.
And I apologize for getting coffee. My wife gets mad at me for doing the same.
Representative Petula.
In the bill, right now, as it came to us from the Senate, we've been told that gas is now at 7.5% of the tax rate, rather than the 22.5 that's on oil. So maybe that's where the confusion is coming. I mean, have you looked at that section on the difference in the tax rates?
The concept is when the. Of course, there has been an evolution of this PPT law and of the gas contract. As you well know, we're facing very tight deadlines, so we had to work in parallel. And at the time when the PPT law was designed, we were still in the middle of very important negotiations about the details of the gas terms with the sponsors themselves. So it was not particularly appropriate to show our hand at that time what, you know, whether 20% for gas was appropriate or not. So in order to protect the state, the governor introduced the 20% for gas. Nevertheless, it was, and I felt relatively comfortable about that because we had the extra protection built in for the smaller companies so that in the case of Cook Inlet, the effect would be very modest. So we looked at the interaction for Cook Inlet, and the interaction for Cook Inlet turned out to be reasonable, and therefore that is why the bill was the way it was. However, I think the Senate is correct in their view that assuming a gas contract goes forward, that there will be potentially producers on the North Slope which may not be part of a gas contract and which may just sell their gas to other large producers at the wellhead. And consequently, if they are not part of this contract, then of course the PPT law has to be good for gas for them as well. And then you get into this whole matter of comparison. How does this now compare, say, with other producers on the North Slope? And I think that is some debate. I understand Econ One has done some work on it. I would be glad to also do some work on it because we have to be very mindful of other producers and not only, you know, of course, our main focus is the sponsors under the stranded gas contract and maybe other producers that would join in similar contracts, but there could be companies out there that would just sell the gas at the wellhead and not be part of any contract, and they should have fair fiscal terms as well. So I think it is a good debate to have. I think it is an important debate to have. And I think the concept of the gross revenue exclusion is a good one. The precise details of this, I will be glad to inform you later on.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to see on page 3 that you, it'd be quite simple to run that particular run out to $100. Could we see that just so we can see both sides?
I would be glad
to have done it. Of course, it is not difficult to do. Actually, the way the graph looks like, I can predict for you how it, I mean, I know it because I did it, but basically the crossover continues, and, you know, if you go to $60, the difference, the positive difference, above 2020 becomes about as much as the negative difference at $20. So the line simply continues to spread. So yes, at $60, of course, the higher tax rate start to become beneficial, and at $60, you will get a slight benefit, say, for the state at those high price levels. At $40, you break even. I showed here the downside because that's what I'm so concerned about. But you're entirely correct. If you go up to $60 or even $80, then, of course, this difference automatically starts to simply continue. The slope of the curve simply continue.
Thank you. When we weigh the credits and the tax, after listening to you and appreciating your view several times now, we've got PPT and then I've got PPM. That's a Pedro's passion meter to try to figure out what concerns you and what doesn't. Your passion meter is a lot higher on the 25% credit than it is on the 25% tax. That's just an observation after having talked to you in this kind of an environment and also one-on-one. But it's interesting that seems to play out as well with the other folks. You know, I know that you're fed and watered on the third floor, and we've got a different team, but one thing's consistent among them. They're all concerned about that credit. They don't seem to be quite so concerned about the 25% tax rate. Am I reading you wrong on that?
I'm very glad that there is a complete new measurement stick with respect to my emotions today. I should be very careful distributing that concept too much in with respect to other emotional relationship. The reason that I was deeply concerned about the 25% tax credit is because I put a lot of effort in it, and I came, and initially I really wanted to come to this legislature and propose 25 just for heavy oil. That was really what I really wanted to recommend to the governor, because I feel that is the future of Alaska. So if we can afford to put 25% in, I absolutely would have recommended it, because I feel that would have been the right thing to do. So I went through quite a process whereby I had to come very reluctantly to the conclusion that Alaska can just not afford it. Like if we are going too far out on the limb if we go for a 25% credit. Between 20 and 25% range, as I have indicated, my studies clearly indicate that you get less activity if you push the tax rate up, and that's self-evident. Consequently, if you go from 20 to 25%, assuming the tax credit stays the same, you will get less activity. I've also represented to the legislature that it is difficult to precisely estimate how much less activity, but you will get less activity. That is clear, because you become less competitive. I also feel that the state needs a significant increase in investment. if you look at this heavy oil. This is oil that could cost $20,000-$30,000 per barrel capacity to bring about. So this requires very large investment. Traditionally, everywhere where heavy oil is being developed, it is slow going. It is difficult, slow going. And so consequently, yes, in particular with respect to the heavy oil, I believe that the impact on less investment could be quite significant. Because, and why do I believe that? Because of what I said. The oil companies are still, my information from PFC Energy and other large consulting firms that keep track of how oil companies forecast oil, is still that many major oil companies consider $35 a barrel a good benchmark for a long term. Now you have to subtract $5 transportation cost. Now you have to subtract a quality differential of maybe $5 or more. So now you are down to $25, really, at the wellhead, or less. By the time you get to those kind of low prices, the tax rates start to become quite important. So, you know, how large the effect is depends on the price assumptions you make, depends on, you know, the kind of oil that you're looking at for development. I can see the effect to be quite negative for heavy oils. I can see the effect to be less negative for light oil. But the general concept that if you push the tax rate up, that you get less activity is self-evident. My analysis clearly shows that it is not immaterial, that the differences are not immaterial. That means it is not something you can just say it is so small, it doesn't matter. Particularly for heavy oil, it is material. So consequently, that is why I think I would caution that tax rate is an important issue. And I'm worried about a little bit the sense that I got from some of the Senate side that they said, oh yeah, we can just up the tax rate if we up the credit rate. I think that is a deadly philosophy. That could really bring the state in trouble. But you're correct. The tax credit effects and the tax rate effects are different. The tax credits have a very negative impact on the risk for the state. The higher the risk to the state of a higher tax rate is not being out of pocket. The risk to the state of a higher tax rate is less activity.
The whole issue of a safety net at lower prices, you know, for a lot larger part of our history, we've been way down on the lower end of the price of the barrel. And if we get back into that arena, then there are most of the family of curves that you and others have generated indicate that we could really be negatively impacted, you know, by not having some sort of a safety net under it. Since at those lower prices, investment isn't the issue, nobody's investing in anything down at $28 a barrel, how could we possibly make a mistake in creating a floor, some fairly simple floor, whether it's cents or dollars per barrel or how you approached it, that says when it is nearly at the point where maybe it ought to be left on the ground or you know, getting close to that, and we're not incenting investment, why shouldn't we be taking a minimum at that point? You know, I've heard arguments that, well, if you're going to take the progressive upside, that you owe it to somebody to do the downside. I don't, that logic escapes me, because it may seem like a fairness issue, but when we're looking at the state of Alaska and what could be lost if we're stuck in some price per barrel between 20 and 28 bucks or somewhere in that arena, why shouldn't we put a safety net in here?
Thank you.
Why shouldn't there be a dual pricing where it's this number under PPT, but not less than?
You are absolutely correct in highlighting the fact that there is a downside. And that is also why I'm so worried about the tax credit. When we did background analysis on the PPT bill, we definitely modeled a minimum tax or a minimum amount. Why did I personally not recommend this to the governor to include? Two main reasons. The first reason is that these minimum taxes, typically around the world, if you want to do it fairly, these minimum taxes should be recoverable if prices go back up. Or in other words, the typical minimum tax is something that is subject to what you call carry forward provision. That means under low prices you pay the minimum tax, but then under high prices you can recover what you paid. So a minimum tax is really an interest-free loan. That's basically what it is during periods of low prices. It doesn't really do that much for the state. I mean, popularly think, you know, we get something, you actually just borrow money at 0% in order to pay it back when the prices are higher. So when we model that effect, really that is not that important for the state. But probably far more other important consideration, and you're entirely correct, at the low prices, people say you increase the taxes relative to where we are. You're entirely correct. If at low prices, the PPT law will generate less income than the current system, although the ELF system, as you well know, after 10 years would be nothing anyway. But in the immediate future, it would generate less, and you're entirely correct. The second reason that I personally felt that there was not a need for a minimum tax is Alaska is unusually well protected on the downside in its revenues in three ways. One, there is a royalty system that is there, and of course under low prices you collect less royalty, but unless the prices are extremely low, the royalties will always be there. So consequently, the first downside protection is you have your royalties. The second downside protection is you have your property taxes. They will always continue. But most interestingly, Alaska has a state corporate income tax that's based on worldwide taxes of the companies. And that has served Alaska so well in the past, because yes, if prices go down, what happens? The net back, the wellhead price in Alaska becomes very low, but not necessarily internationally. Internationally, you're closer to the market. So interestingly, if prices go down, state corporate income tax stays substantive because it is based on worldwide income. So Alaska has a very significant downside protection already built in the overall fiscal structure. So if you take into consideration that Alaska has already better downside protection than many other jurisdictions in the world, and if you take into consideration that a minimum tax is really nothing more than an interest-free loan anyway, I felt that it was not worth the complication in this PPT. It will be very complex to write because this will you have to go into the carry forwards, and so I felt it was just not worth it to include it, because it really, if you do the economic modeling of it, it really doesn't bring a lot to the state. So that's the reason why I recommend it not to include it.
I guess if we were stuck there for an extended period of time trying to fund state government, some of those more esoteric interest-free loans and that sort of thing would fade from memory, and we'd wish to hell we'd have put one in there. But that's, you haven't said different.
That is,
I can drop the thing and stop and let somebody else take a turn and come back.
Senator Kelly.
The the whole issue of this tax, or the what Representative Wyrock was getting to, of the you've made a profit and you're trying to tax that profit. We're stuck with this silly system, which if I were consultants and lawyers in about 1900, I'd have set up this really bizarre thing where you're trying to price a commodity with a complicated tax system, because it isn't a tax at all in my mind. It's a how do you value that commodity and how do you change that over time. So you have this very complex system that only consultants and lawyers can understand. With no offense, you seem to understand it better than most. But
my PPM is going up,
your PPM is going up, yeah. My question is this. Back to what Representative Wyrock was saying, we've cut through this GRE thing over on the other, in the other body. We've taken what used to be kind of two-thirds, one-third, and we've flipped that over, and we're one-third, two-thirds, and he's scratching at something that I'm just wondering why would we let that slide? Because although we may, well, let me stop there. Why would we go that low?
No, as I mentioned, I really like to do the figures myself before. I understand Econ One has done some analysis on it. I like to see what they've done. I have to do the analysis myself, and therefore, at this time, I can't really comment on what the correct numbers would be, or what I would recommend as numbers, but I would be glad to try to do that as soon as possible. Obviously, we are in a short timeline here. The PPT as such is not, by international standards, a complex system. It is a system that most nations has used very successfully to promote their oil business. And consequently, a profit, the international experience indicates that you get more investment with a profit-based system than a system that is based on gross values. And that is why we're doing it. Is a net profit share somewhat more difficult to administer than a gross profit share? Of course it is. You now go into deductions of cost and so on. But you know, if Algerians can do it and Indonesians can do it and Norwegians can do it, why can't Alaskans do it? Like it is, these are systems that are used all over the world. They're very well established. The oil industry is very familiar with them. Governments are very familiar with them. There are well-established practices how you do things, how you deduct costs, how you account for them. There is an extensive body of practices of how you do joint venture agreements, how you audit them. So, although it may appear maybe somewhat complex in Alaska, if you look at it from the outside, it is not necessarily a very complex system. And since the international experience is that nations with a profit-based system get more investment than nations that don't have profit-based systems, that is the main reason for the recommendation.
Yeah,
I'm too old to benefit for the next 30 years of this the complex system.
And I'm not speaking against at all.
No.
What I'm speaking against is the math in that current GRE that gives me great concern, because and you said as much that you would like to look at it, but I just want to weigh in on that same area, because it looks like could be a big problem. Just two last questions. The effective date and the clawback. What impact will either one of those have on the long-term investment strategy of the, you know, how we structure those two on the long-term investment strategy of the oil companies?
No. The what I had given to the suggestion of the legislature is this two-for-one system, because I feel positive about the fact that we should reward companies that indeed now go after this oil and indeed increase their levels of investment. I feel positive about that, and I think that's what the state needs. So personally, I like this two-for-one concept. I think it was a good concept that the legislature came up with, and I think I would recommend it to this committee as well. Of course, the effective date is a matter of pure money. If you make the effective date somewhat earlier, you collect a little bit more, and if you do it a little bit later, you collect a little bit less this year. It has, but that impacts on the cash flow this year. For the following years, it would not make any difference. But obviously, there would be quite a significant impact this year, one way or another. And there is also what you need to consider is typically, although I stated that this whole PPP is not necessarily more complex than other fiscal features in the world, it would still require DOR some time to get organized and to start monitoring this. So that is why the governor's bill didn't include a retroactive concept. That is why we said, okay, once it is passed, let's get organized, let's do things properly, not rush everything and create the administrative problems. And so consequently, I think that was the main reason, the fairness of starting it only after the law has passed, and the fact that it would permit the administration a more orderly transition. That were the main arguments. But it is obvious if you start it earlier, you collect some more money.
As you look, last one, guaranteed. as you look around the world at your experience, what's the most severe retroactive shot you've seen, and what's the mean?
Most laws in the world are from then forwards. In fact, as I mentioned, I think, to other legislators, another client that I'm very much involved with right now is Algeria, which just passed a PPT-style profits-based tax. Interestingly, Algeria decided to wait even more than a year. They said, okay, we need to get properly organized for this, so they actually made the start of the PPT a year after the tax law was passed. So, and I'm in fact helping them right now to get organized, so consequently, the real international practice is to, you know, if you pass a new fiscal system, to make it applicable after the law has passed retroactively, and from a fairness point of view and from an organizational point of view. I actually cannot immediately think of another example where there was significant retroactivity in a profits-based tax. I cannot think of an example right now.
Any other questions? Pedro, I got a couple. Earlier you stated, and maybe I misunderstood, but you stated that there's countries in other areas of the world that are structuring their gas taxation to get into the U.S. market?
Yes.
Okay. Why would the U.S. market be any different than any other market in the world? They structure their tax, their gas tax structure to get into the U.S. market.
Representative General. I meant to say other nations are structuring their taxation system, of course, to reach the world markets, including the U.S. market. Let me give you, my example, Trinidad and Tobago, for instance, which has been a client of mine for almost 20 years now. And in Trinidad and Tobago, there were huge gas resources in the country, there still are, and consequently, and they had a rather strong system, progressive system for oil, which I also helped them design. And then we looked at gas, and we came to the conclusion that in the case of Trinidad and Tobago, for instance, the logical markets would be the U.S. and Europe. And in fact, that happened. They started LNG exports to the U.S. and to Europe. So we studied how the value of gas would be if you sold it in Spain and in the United States from Trinidad. And that was the basis for the fiscal design for gas, because that were the only large markets available. So I did not necessarily mean to say that everybody is structuring their fiscal terms just for the U.S. market. They are structuring their gas for long-distance transportation, whether that goes to Europe or whether it goes to the U.S. or Asia, that is another matter.
Second question, on your level of activity and tax rates, we really don't have a number here that's 22-25. We have 25-20 and 25-20. I'd be curious, and you don't have to do a run, I would just be interested in what the 22.5-25 does versus what the 20-20 or you even have a 25-20 in here.
You mean in the graph that I...
Right, in the graph.
Oh, just no problem whatsoever to run other cases and add them to the graph. It would be a pleasure to do.
And this is just something that just kind of intrigues me, I guess, because I don't know enough about it. But at 158, under $36 barrel at 25.20 in Alaska's current system, at 158 we're regressive, and at 153 we're neutral. But if I go down and I look at others like Angola, or I look at Russia Sakhalin, we become progressive at 158, or at 226. I haven't sat down and really looked at this thing in itself, but it kind of strikes me as interesting to look at whether you're regressive or progressive or neutral, and the numbers can be high, low, or in between.
Oh, sorry, I should have maybe spent a little bit more time explaining this chart. What does this chart mean? This is what you call a competitiveness rating chart. So on page 5, it is a competitiveness rating chart. And the lower the number, the more attractive the fiscal system is. So if you look at that chart, you see that the U.S. Gulf of Mexico has very low numbers, 27, 25, which means that the U.S. Gulf of Mexico is the most attractive fiscal system on this list. If you add, say, Russia, Sakhalin, you see very high numbers, 214, 226, and so on, which means it is a very unattractive fiscal system. If you look at Alaska Current and Alaska PPT, what you see is that there is no question that the PPT makes Alaska more competitive relative to the current system, and consequently, in general, I believe, therefore, that you will see more activity as a result of the PPT, and that is the reason why you move to a profit-based system. Then if you move between the columns, you see that if you go from 2520 to 2020, that the numbers become lower. Say from 158, it drops to 154, or from 153, it drops to 147. So that means Alaska becomes more competitive at a lower tax rate, which of course is self-evident. But that is what these figures mean. So these figures mean nothing more than a general competitiveness rating among the fiscal systems that I studied there. So, and the numbers themselves have no more meaning than that it is the relative rating relative to other fiscal systems. Then I have a column, I should have separated a little bit, then I have a column to describe the nature of the fiscal systems, either as regressive, neutral, or progressive, and I should have had a little bit of a space in between there, my apologies for that, to explain why the numbers drop or increase. Progressive systems, as you can see, these higher prices become less competitive, like Norway. Regressive systems, like the original, the current, say, Alaska system, becomes more attractive if prices go up. So that is really an explanation of the numbers. And my apologies, I should have spent some more time explaining it.
Not a problem. Just an interesting thing to look at and try to figure it out. Anyway, any other questions? Representative Curtula.
Could I just ask what the U-shape is?
The U-shape, that is an interesting thing in Azerbaijan. You'll have some fiscal systems that are regressive at very low prices because they have fixed features in it, like royalties or bonuses. But then at average prices, the government take becomes less. If you then go up to higher prices, the system becomes progressive. So it is regressive under low prices, progressive under high prices, and if you make the curve, that kind of looks like a U, so that's why it is called a U-shape.
Thank you.
Yeah. Happy face.
Any other questions? Representative Meyer.
Just one. I'd just be curious as to what your crystal ball shows for the price of oil over, say, the next year, next 5 years. I mean, obviously, nobody knows, or we wouldn't be here. But what are you forecasting? I think we'd heard from Econ One that they're using a range somewhere between 40 and 49, and I'd just be curious to see what you're using.
My forecasting history has been very good, of course. In 1973, I was a petroleum economist in Energy, Mines and Resources, which is the Canadian equivalent of DNR. And my role was to forecast the oil price. In 1973, I forecasted that the oil price may be as high as $5 a barrel in 1980. And then the people in the department saw that that was a crazy forecast, and they whittled me down to $4 a barrel. Now, there you see how difficult it is to forecast. My own attitude is the same as what I think many oil companies do these days. If you study an important project like the Alaska Gas Project or other investment projects, you really compare it for any price. You really look at the project at any price level. The project has to be attractive, has to be acceptable across a whole range of prices. And because we are talking about investments that will take 50 years, and it is just impossible to predict what the price will be. The world is too complex to really forecast. So many oil companies are now forecasting on what you call a price deck. They don't use one price forecast anymore. They use several forecasts, and they then analyze how the project behaves under different forecasting. My own price deck, what I believe is a good forecast. It's not very different from what most major oil companies would do today, which is, I believe it is a good solid forecast to use a long-term forecast of $35 a barrel. That is a good, at the low end, I think you have to be prepared for $22 per barrel. And at the high end, you may be between 50 and 60 on a long-term basis. And that is what I think a consensus view is among many large oil companies, and I really have no difference with that view. I believe that is a good, as you call, price deck for the future. What the oil price would be next year, I would be very rich if I knew.
Okay. So if I may follow up, the current oil prices then you don't think are sustainable, or because you're saying your high range is about 60, and I think we're currently at 65 or something. So
yeah, even over 70.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I believe that what I have seen, I've been in this business now for 35 years as a consultant, and what I believe is that what I have seen so many times is action creates reaction, and if prices go up strongly, thousands of activities take place around the world that will react to these high prices, and suddenly all these thousands of activities then result in counter forces that bring the price back down again. And very simple things could bring the price back down again. A simple change in Chinese policy on prices of petroleum products. China is actually subsidizing their petroleum product prices. If China would change that policy, that could have a big impact on world demand. Simple things like that, and thousands of activities of that nature could bring the price down very easily. And that is why, so with the assessment of the PPT, we have to be mindful of the fact that the current high oil prices may not be there for a very long time, and that prices may indeed decline back to more moderate levels. I see a good possibility for that. How it precisely will work, I haven't done any analysis of that, nor am I really the right person to do that, because I have my database is not set up for that.
But then, if I may, Mr. Chairman, on the flip side, you know, any even minor event in the Middle East could cause the price to continue to go upward. You know, Iran in particular is a very precarious situation right now. And I think that's why the progressivity is so important to us. And I know in the governor's original proposal, he didn't have a progressivity factor. What's your thoughts on that? It just seems like that's almost necessary to protect us on the upside if oil were to go up to $100 or $150.
Yes, I in all of my testimony, as you know, I am still very proud of having actually being able to contribute to the creation of the Stranded Gas Development Act in the first place in 1998 as advisor to the state. And obviously, I testified many times in those days that, you know, progressivity is an important feature. What I like to highlight is that the PPT was a progressive system. So although there was no special progressive feature in it, the tax credits made the PPT a progressive system. So I recommended the governor a tax that was progressive in my mind because of the tax credits. And I'm in favor of progressivity. I've always been in favor of progressivity. What the legislature has done is, in addition to the progressivity that was already embedded in the structure of the PPT, an additional further feature was introduced. And I really don't have strong feelings about that. I think that could work very well. Other than that, I would caution that if you want a nominal price to be used as benchmark, you have to be careful and you have to be mindful of the heavy oils that we have, and you should take that into consideration. But yes, as you say, one of my large clients is Kuwait, and after 3 weeks I will return to Kuwait, and precisely to work on the kind of things that you said. Kuwait is looking at expanding the North Kuwait oil field with about 300,000 barrels a day, and that is what I literally will be working on. And it is very difficult to bring about very quickly large supply increases in the Middle East. right now. So there is no question that, you know, OPEC is now at a point, and I know that from my client Kuwait, OPEC is now definitely at a point where it is difficult to rapidly increase supplies further. And so consequently, unless there is an important demand reaction to the high prices, the supply side definitely points to higher prices.
For the record, Representative Holm has been with us. Representative Holm, did you have any questions? Maybe he's not there.
Finding the mute
button. He's there. Anyway, Representative Wyrock.
I want to get a threshold question off my chest. Seems like when we started originally dealing with this, it was a threshold matter that we wanted to address oil tax policy and oil taxation as a framework and a bed for dealing then with the gas contract under the Standard Gas Act. But now we've integrated gas into this whole PPT bill, and we've got a level of uncertainty here. Have you or the administration prepared a model about the effect of this tax rate that is now in the bill before us on what that means for income to the state and impact on the producers at all?
Yes. To begin with.
So the question is, have you, two questions. Why have we morphed from an oil tax bill to an oil and gas tax bill? And have you or the administration prepared a model of what the impact of the gas tax rate is that's in this bill and what it means to the state?
Well, you give it to us.
No. All the answers are yes. Yes, the state has, there are two broad models in the state. The revenue models, which are really done in DOR, and then there is more the investment style models, which I am responsible for. So we worked in parallel with my models and the DOR models. The PPT bill that was introduced right from the beginning always applied to oil and gas. So it was never the idea not to to separate oil and gas. And it was for the reason that I also explained to Representative Kertula, which is that we didn't want to have to separate out capital cost for gas and capital cost for oil. So the concept was always that this bill would apply to oil and gas. Of course, the concept was also that subsequent to the PPT law being passed, we would present to the legislature the stranded gas contract, which would completely modify the gas terms, say for North Slope gas, at least for those who would have agreements. So we were well aware of the fact, and we took that into very serious consideration. We were well aware of the fact that, of course, the PPT law would apply to, producers in Cook Inlet that are current gas producers. And that is precisely why my recommendation was to have the $73 million allowance, because my analysis was that most of the producers in the Cook Inlet were smaller companies, and in order to protect the smaller companies and the smaller levels of production in the Cook Inlet, we brought right from the beginning this allowance in. Now, this allowance has now been changed, through the various drafts, but the purpose of that allowance was to be able to present an oil and gas PPT bill through the allowance, not have a negative impact on Cook Inlet. And since we were going to change subsequently the gas regime on the basis of the stranded gas contract, we did the analysis in that framework. And consequently, however, of course, the models are well set up to run any kind of economics, including PPT gas economics, on the gas line, and of course, we have done that kind of economics, and
And as I promised, I would be glad to provide information to the legislature of what the impact of that GRP is. You are rightfully concerned about it. It's an extremely important question. It is an idea that was brought forward recently, and it merits very, very serious analysis.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Dr. Van Meers, for your testimony before House Finance today.
It was a great pleasure.
We have a floor session in about 5 minutes, so I know that Dr. Finitz is online. We're going to try to bring him back at the 1 o'clock meeting, and we're going to do public testimony, and we'll also hear from Econ 1 this afternoon. Representative Kelly?
Well, we have, did that phone call thing work for Daniel Johnson?
Not as far as I'm aware yet, but
it may be an option we'll try to do. I got up at 4 this morning, so 3 a.m. shouldn't be too bad. Anyway, with that, the bells are ringing. Bring the meeting to a close, and we'll see you at 1 o'clock. Thank you.